Good afternoon. Welcome to the Poison Pen and an afternoon of travel and adventure. And in fact, the only way right now that Americans could go to Iceland or Greece is this way, since the EU has already announced that we can't go there. But Tim, writing about Bangkok, we probably could still visit Thailand if we were so inclined. So Ragnar, this is The Mist, is your third book in the whole, I'm never going to say this quite right, Hermannsdóttir?
Yeah, Hulda Hermannsdóttir.
I knew I couldn't do that quite right. I've tried Swedish too and completely flunked. But anyway, this is your Hidden Iceland series. But you really began, if I recall right, with a detective called Ari Thor.
Yes, so that was my first series. That was five books, so it will actually be six books as of later of this year. And that was set in the northernmost town of in Iceland, where my father grew up and where I spent a part of the summer always, but I'm actually now in Reykjavik. And but this second series with Hulda is set in Reykjavik and also in sort of different parts of Iceland. And The Mist actually takes place in the eastern part of Iceland, the middle of winter, right before Christmas, in an isolated farmhouse where there are only two people living, a couple, and they're getting everything ready for Christmas. It's the day before Christmas and they are basically snowed in, as they are every year, because they're so far away from the next town. And then on the day before Christmas Eve, a stranger knocks on their door and, you know, tells them the story that he's been lost while hunting. And nothing about his story rings true, and they're stuck with this unexpected guest in the middle of nowhere, with the weather, you know, turning pretty bad.
So is this actually 1987? Because at least the first book, if I recall, is 1987.
Yeah, so the books actually, they go back in time. So so the Hulda, the detective of the series, we meet her in the first book when she's 64 and she's about to retire from the police and dealing with her final case. And then in the second book, which was called The Island, we meet her like around 10 years earlier when she's in the sort of peak of her career. And The Mist, this takes place even 10 years before that. And then she is around 40 years old and sort of again in the peak or early days of her career. So so that was basically the idea with this series from the start, was to tell the story of the lead character in reverse. So the reader always knows a little bit more than she does about how her life will go. And it was a really enjoyable experience, like experimenting with that concept.
So when I looked at your website, I do know that this was, in theory, the last. It's a trilogy, but there was some hint that if not Hulda, at least another character might appear in a future book.
Yes, yeah, so it is a trilogy. And this is definitely the end of the trilogy. But I grew to like Hulda, so she actually did return as like a secondary character in a series that I am starting. Writing, where I thought my idea for that one was, because in the first book about Hulda, she is asked to retire at 64, like a year early, because they need her to empty her office, because there's a young hotshot detective coming into the police force and he needs her office, and we never meet that guy. So I thought, you know, why not write a series about that guy? And so the new series I'm working on now in Iceland is all about that, you know, that young man who takes over Hulda's job. And so in the first book about him, we sort of see the last days of Hulda in her job from his point of view. So she makes another appearance, at least one more.
Tim, are you waving or do you have something you want to say?
I just want to say that I think that's one of the best ideas I ever heard, moving backward in the life of the main character. I've never heard of it before. it gives me green envy all the way to my toes, and I think it's brilliant. That was what I wanted to say. Great idea.
So when we're talking to you, sir, we seem to have this strange intrusion of people, which has never come up before. Tim, you, on the other hand, have carried us forward in the life of Pope Rafferty and the family that he has created. And this book is really what you think of as the final book in that series, right?
Yeah, I'd be surprised if it's not. I mean, I intentionally framed it as that when I began to think of it. It answers the last big unanswered question about this little sort of ad hoc family that my character has put together in Bangkok.
Well, I thought one of the wonderful things about reading it is the tour we end up taking of Bangkok, which you know so well. I am in your honor wearing my jacket that I bought in the Bangkok airport, which I have to tell you is a really dangerous place for a traveler on a long layover with a credit card. But last time you were in Scottsdale with me for your last book, Rafferty, you and I managed to get lost in downtown Scottsdale, which is a real achievement. So I wondered how you were so sure-footed around Bangkok. It obviously is a city that you know very well.
Well, in writing, unlike in life, there's a delete key. And every time I make a big mistake, I just cut it. In fact, I barely know Bangkok at all. I know it emotionally, and I know quite a bit about the people who live there. But Bangkok's enormous, and I'm really only familiar with one part of it that's on one side of the river, of the Chao Phraya River that flows through it. And it's like Los Angeles in that they knock down huge portions of it every year and erect really uninteresting condominiums. But the interesting thing to me is that I continually get letters from people who say, you know, I followed your directions and I couldn't find that restaurant. And I say, well, that's because you were looking for a fictional restaurant. If you'd been on a fictional street, you would have found the restaurant. So some people apparently buy it lock, stock, and barrel, which is good.
Oh, that's a wonderful cue to talk to Jeffrey, because Mykonos is a place absolutely overrun with mass tourism. Do you find that people take your books as a guide to night spots and other hot spots of Mykonos?
Well, as a matter of fact, Photo's Guide published an article on the islands of Greece in the Cyclades, and it said that for Mykonos, take a look at Mykonos After Midnight by Jeffrey Sager to see what the nightlife was like. I couldn't believe that. The Photo's actually listed my book as a way to go to those places. I actually try to tie things together so that if you go to an area, you'll actually see it. I take great care in that. Because I don't have the mind that Tim has to make it up. So I have to do it by mapping it out. That's what I like to do.
How many years have you been going to spend the whole summer, and actually more than that, in Mykonos?
Oh, the whole summer, I'd say it's been about 15 years. But I've been going there 35 years. Not more than a summer, 6 months.
So are you having withdrawal at the moment?
I am, as a matter of fact. I'm constantly in touch with my friends over there. Mykonos is going through a strange time. My latest book, which is The Mykonos Mob in hardcover and softcover, it's now Island of Secrets. It's like the third book about Mykonos that I've written. And what it gets into is the wildly lucrative dark side of that island being a playground for worlds rich and famous. I mean, it talks about the people who are battling for control of its vices and the innocents affected by it all. And it's sad for me to write that book, but I wrote it because the island has lost its heart, I believe, and the Mykonians would agree with that. Here's the reason I'm saying that. You ask me, what do I think now? Everybody I talked to said, my God, it's Mykonos now is like the 1970s. Bicycling, the beaches are free, the clubs aren't there, we love it. This may be the chance for them to reclaim their island to some extent. I mean, when you have clubs that are making a million euros a night, it's hard to cut in on that. But enough of the Mykonians are realizing what the island used to be like, that this could be the kick it gets to try to reclaim something. I'm hoping so.
But I think that's true. There was a terrific essay, I'm trying to remember if it was the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, about mass travel and how this may give us a big reset. Ragnar, I've been to Iceland, trying to remember, either 3 or 4 times, and always enjoyed it. Always by ship, and therefore more on the perimeter than, and in Reykjavik, but not really traveling to the interior, such as the Mist is, takes us to. What does Iceland think about the loss of tourism?
It's quite a shock to the economy here, because we have been, you know, we have become very reliant on tourism as like probably our biggest industry in recent years. So there is quite a bit of unemployment now, because we basically have had no tourists, but the government is quite sort of ready to open up again to tourists as quickly as possible to get the economy going, and we actually did that on June 15th. We opened up the country again, and we're hoping, you know, hopefully soon we can. So it's mostly open to Europeans now, but I think we're hoping to be able to include the rest of the world quite soon. And so the tourists are we're seeing, one or two tourists now and again these days, and it's a great relief, because we are a country of 350,000 people, but we have maybe like 2 million tourists here last year. So the inflow of tourists basically, enables us to keep the great restaurants going, downtown quite vibrant and lively, etc. So I hope this recovers quite fast.
Well, Iceland is bigger than Mykonos, and certainly bigger than Venice. Donna Leon and I have been emailing about what Venice is like without tourists, and it's certainly very different. Tim, one of the things I thought was very interesting in street music was, and there's some really aging Americans that are in it, Vietnam War veterans and so forth, and I thought you did a great job of explaining why, or making us understand why, these people were drawn to Bangkok, why these men were drawn to Bangkok, and why some of them chose to live on in Bangkok.
Well, I think a lot of people think that, you know, Bangkok has probably been Sin City forever and it's Asian morals or whatever the hell. But in fact, the first sex industry in Bangkok was established during the Vietnam War. It was established for American servicemen who were on leave. 3 or 4 places opened up. Only 2 of them are still open. Soy Cowboy, which is named after an American soldier. His name was Cowboy. And which is the most infamous of them all. A lot of the guys from Vietnam were emotionally wrecked, because they realized when they got over there that they were essentially fighting a war that should never have been declared in the first place. They were seeing their friends get killed, and they were having a lot of doubts and second thoughts that people didn't have in the Second World War and in the other possibly juster wars. And they went to Bangkok for R&R, rest and recreation, and they found a really fledgling sex industry in which the workers were farm girls, really nice girls who had come down to make enough money to pay for their parents' farms. And a lot of people fell in love. And those are almost all unhappy love stories. But all of the, even the men who didn't fall in love, a lot of them decided that Bangkok was where they wanted to be after the war. And there has been a large post-Vietnam population in Bangkok ever since, dwindling now because of age. By the way, there used to be a bar called Lucy's Tiger Den, where all the intelligence guys from the Soviet Union, from South Vietnam, from the United States, from China, all met at night. This is up until about 3 years ago, and retold the stories in which they tried to kill each other. So the whole sex industry in Bangkok is sort of a delayed echo of the Vietnam War, and a lot of those guys are still there. And as in street music, they're old and they're beginning to die. And some of them are doubting the choices they made that took her in the first place. I wrote them into the very first book, a bar called The Expat Bar, and they've been in every book since, and I'm gonna miss them because I really like writing them.
Well, they make an interesting background for a story of an American journalist expat who has tried to forge a family for himself, both with a wife and a child adopted off the streets. So I do think the contrast gives a lot of power to your books. And I'm sad too to be letting them go. I've been so fond of them. I keep hoping that maybe some new story will occur to you and they'll come back. But sometimes things just come to an end. So Jeffrey, you introduced a character in Island of Secrets that had actually first appeared. You and I have a long history together. Me as your editor and your big fan. And now she appears as a female piano player in a gay bar in Mykonos. Why did you make that transition?
We're talking about Tony.
Right.
Another way I could, if someone said in a phrase, how do you describe Island of Secrets? I'd say it's basically, it's a Me Too movement piece. Because there are very strong women in this book. It's what I wrote it for. I felt that it was time to write it that way. And Tony just hit me as somebody who could express so much of what it means to have grown up and the life she had to be where she is now. So that she seemed to be a natural for me in this particular book. And she continues to grow. She actually grows into another. But that particular scene, or rather that particular setting on an island, which has become so much one of, frankly, I felt it was necessary to insert some sense of passion, understanding, and perhaps a better look at what it means to be working on an island like that. And that's really what drove me to bring Tony into that picture.
I like her a lot as a character. So when we started with Murder in Mykonos all those years back, Chief Inspector Andreas Kaldos, as he is, was stationed in Mykonos, but then he's gone back to Athens, and he too has created a family. He's gotten married, he has children. So you've explored other islands in Greece. Is there other sections of Greece, not just islands, but like Santorini and Mykonos, but other parts of the country? What draws you to any particular part of Greece to write a story?
Oh, well, Greece is the source of so much. I mean, it's the birthplace of Western civilization. I mean, you have Spartan courage, the Trojan intrigues, you have all this. And it just, everything is there. But what really draws me to these islands are the people. I go there and I meet people and I become part of that community while I'm working on that book. I get an introduction, go to Sparta, go to Lesbos. The new book, which I just finished, which will be coming out next year, is based on the island of Naxos. I went to Naxos, I stayed in a hotel. Who am I staying with? He's the owner, it's the mayor of the town. So I'm now in a position where I'm getting all this information. They love to talk to writers, as everyone will say. They love to talk to writers. And so I find myself being part of the community. And it's just something I've just taken to, and I love doing it. So that's why I go to these places and I write about the places.
Well, I guess my question is, does the story come first and then you find the place, or do you find a place that you want to explore and then the story sort of generates out of that?
Well, I usually say, that's a nice island. Now, what am I going to do with it? Sometimes the story is first on my mind. But yeah, I don't really know when I start to write where my book's going to head. I really don't know. At some point, I say, I better figure out where the ending's going to be here. And that's how I work. But I've had different things happen. I mean, the one I wrote about Maldathos, which is the holiest area of Greece, that one came to me as a result of a passing conversation I had with someone. The first one in Mykonos came to me at a funeral. I mean, I don't know what brings them on. I'm sure that Ragnar and Tim have the same experiences. Things just burst in your mind. Say, this could be a story. Now, how do I get there? And that's really how I've been doing it. I must say that my last book I just wrote, the one about Naxos, has drawn me to a place which reminds me of Mykonos many years before. And it's just, there's something special about it. So I say, well, where's the next special place I'm going to find? That's exciting. I mean, keep going. I mean, I figure there's maybe, let's say, 300 or 400 islands that I could write about. I'm only in the book 12. So I got a while to go yet.
So do either of you, Ragnar, you want to speak to that too? Where, you know, do you find the place and then the story, or do you find the story or the characters and then find the place?
It's a little bit different, but it's sometimes, you know, it's quite linked, you know. For me, the starting of the story is very important, and, you know, but I think usually the plot or the idea comes to me first. But then, you know, quite soon after, I find the, you know, what I would think is the perfect place for this. And as Jeff has all his islands, we have all these different parts of Iceland, the south, you know, islands off the south, which I've actually used, and then the north, which I use a lot. And you can, you know, I've found some, you know, lost villages in Iceland that I love to work and, you know, sort of play with people who are, places where people have lived in the past, but are like abandoned now. And you can do a lot of sort of scary stuff with settings like that. But yeah, I think it's quite closely linked, the plot and the setting for me. Both are very important.
I do think you could have written The Mist if you couldn't have found such an isolated place. In fact, it was a really scary book to read right now when we're self-isolating. But in a way, it makes it a little more comfortable to be self-isolating rather than be enduring the kind of isolation that you inflict on your characters in this book. So you did have to pick a completely remote farmhouse, right, in order to make this story go?
Yes. For The Mist, actually, the story... the setting came sort of first. I was reading about some years ago, before Christmas, I was reading this article about people in Iceland who actually live, who still live like this, who there are not many of them, like a handful of people who live in very isolated farms, even to this day, and even, you know, at wintertime when there's a lot of snow, they are quite cut off, maybe even without, you know, proper telephone signals or without television. And reading this story sort of sparked The Mist. I thought, you know, if how interesting it might be to explore the lives of these people like this, and, you know, how the isolation, you know, in my imagination, how the isolation can sort of play tricks on the mind, and then, you know, what happens when someone unexpected comes along. And once I decided to write about that, I basically had to just find the right place. And I think it could have been anywhere in, you know, anywhere in Iceland. I mean, but I chose the east because it's a part of Iceland I hadn't used before. And they have, you know, these areas like this where you go inland into these valleys or pretty far away. And I was actually just last night in the Icelandic Highlands. And there is so much empty space in the middle of Iceland, you cannot believe it. I mean, Iceland is 100,000 square kilometers, and it's quite a big island with very few people living here. And so finding a place to write about where, you know, far away from everything is not very difficult. Just so many places where you can just get lost and meet no one for days.
Iceland is magic.
Yes, it is. It's one of my favorite places to visit. I know that you probably have questions for each other, and this sort of jerks around a little bit, but let me just ask one more of Tim, and then if you want to raise your hand in order to, I don't know how else to cue this to speak, we can do that. Tim, both Ragnar and Jeff are really writing police procedurals, i.e., you know, the main character, the sleuth, is an actual cop. So it's a little different with Poke because he's an amateur. So what have you done to make it possible for Poke to actually investigate crimes and in theory bring some bad guys to justice?
You mean why is it plausible? Do I have to change things around to make it seem plausible? Because in fact, Bangkok is a very ad lib city. The cops are enormously corrupt. If you get robbed, you don't go to the cops because they'll take whatever else is left if they can. So solving crimes in Bangkok on a certain level is a freelance activity. But you know, there's a long tradition of people being called into action to right a wrong who are not official cops. And the thing about Polk is that he's a journalist and he's used to asking questions and he's used to sort of sizing out, assessing out the terrain before he sticks his neck out. But to me, since I never have any idea where I'm going when I start a book, I really envy people who know what their story is. I have no idea. To me, what matters is that he's a member of a family. And from the very first sentence in the very first book has him holding his 8-year-old adopted daughter's hand as they follow his wife down the sidewalk grocery shopping. Because I wanted to make it clear that this was not a book about Thailand in which beautiful women throw themselves at uninteresting white men. And once I'd started that, I discovered that I had a self-generating engine. The story, it's the family itself, three completely different people. Each of them have rich pasts. So the problem for me in writing these books has been eliminating a story that I don't want, not making up story when I need it. I'm really going to miss them. I have to tell you, I really am going to miss them.
So Jeffrey, do you have questions you'd like to address to either author? Why don't we move into the you talk to each other phase of this?
Tim, what's the next junior bender going to be about?
It's called Rimshot, and it takes place in a rundown little theater on Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles during the last three nights of the most disastrous oldies rock tour in history. And as someone who spent many years in rock and roll, I've had more fun writing it than I've had doing anything in a very, very long time. I think it's really funny. I don't know where it's going, but then I never know where it's going. So I'm at home with that.
And Ragnar, I want to thank you for organizing one of the best conferences you can find, Iceland Noir. I love it. Hello?
Did we lose you briefly?
Lose me?
No, back.
Ragnar. Ragnar, can you hear us?
Yeah.
I was complimenting you on what you've done to create Iceland Noir, which is one of the best. It's a gem of a conference. I absolutely love it there. And I'm very proud that I actually got my name on your first book.
So are you coming back, Jeff, this year?
I wouldn't miss it. I'm not sure my granddaughter will make it this trip, but she still loves it. She runs around with Aunt Irsta.
So, Ragnar, tell us a little more about the conference. It's in what, November?
Yeah, so it's in November every 2 years, and it's run by me and a few of my friends, four Icelandic crime authors. And it's just like a hobby we do. That's why it's every 2 years, because we don't really have the time to do it every year. But every 2 years, it's like a fantastic weekend. We get maybe 100 or 150 guests, maybe half of them authors. And it's, like an opportunity to experience Iceland in November when you have the Northern Lights and the proper darkness. I mean, now I'm outside, it's almost 10 o'clock at night here.
Wow.
But it's perfectly bright. So in November, it's the exact opposite. So we have a lot of fun with that, and this year we're definitely going ahead with the festival in spite of everything. It seems like most of the crime festivals of the world have been cancelled, but we are still very much hoping to have Iceland Noir this year, and we have four guests of honor this year, which are Ian Rankin and Louise Penny and Anne Cleves and Anthony Horowitz. So I think we'll have some fun.
So is English the common language of the conference? It seems to be, when I've been in Iceland, that virtually everybody has studied English in school and speaks it well.
Yes, so the conference takes place entirely in English.
And when you write, sorry, go ahead. No, I interrupted you. Finish.
No, I was just saying the majority of the guests of the conference are usually visitors from abroad. So it's very much sort of an international festival.
So when you write, because I know that you began your interest in crime, or at least you fostered your interest in crime by translating Agatha Christie into Icelandic when you were a teenager on up. Do you write in Icelandic and then they're translated into English, or how does it work?
Yeah, so I write all my novels in Icelandic, and then I have these fantastic translators that translate them into English, but I write a little bit in English as well, but that would be just short stories. So I try to write a short story a couple every year. I'm working on one now, actually, just today. That's sort of like a different game, more like a hobby. I mean, you know, you get a chance to write about something different, and I have been publishing stories in Ellery Queen's mystery magazine in the US, which was like one of my favorite magazines reading when I was growing up as a teenager. And so I was so honored when they accepted my first story some years ago, and I've done quite a few with them since. So usually I try to write a story every year for them, at least.
Tim, do you have questions you want to ask anybody?
The question that I get asked most of all, this is really sort of off track, but when I do bookstore things, there are always a lot of wannabe writers. And the most frequently asked question is, how often do you write? What starts you off? How much do you write every day? Where do your ideas come from? Any of those, if this is okay with you, I hope that I'm asking that, because I get asked those every time I do an appearance. So either of you want to say anything about that? Let's start with Jeffrey.
I try to write when I get up, so I get up late. Yeah, I try to write whenever I get up and spend the afternoon doing that and then go off and do other things. But I get into a zone at times where you don't want to walk away from the keyboard, because you're afraid you'll lose the ideas or use the flow. That's what I do here. When I'm in Greece, it's a different thing. I mean, my writing patterns have changed. Usually I'm over in Greece right now doing research. But I try to write every day. It may not be a book. It may be a blog. It may be an article for a magazine or for a newspaper. But I try to write every day. You don't want to lose the muscle tone that you get.
Ragnar?
Yeah, so what I do is I write every day in the winter, and I usually write at night, like, or you know, late evening. The winters in Iceland they tend to be dark and you know, sort of cold. It's a great way to spend the winter. It's just indoors, writing at night, and I write every day, you know, from maybe from September until Christmas, and then after Christmas up until spring. And that usually gets me through one novel every year. And I always, so the writing a book is always, you know, number one on my list every day. So if I'm asked to like do an interview or edits or something else, I only do that if I've finished, you know, what I was going to write. So sometimes other things have to wait, because I know if I start putting other things first, then, you know, it's all about the writing. You know, you can't lose focus there. But in the summertime, I mean, on nights like this, when you can stay out until like, you know, whenever, I mean, the sun sets at like 1 a.m. and rises again at 3 a.m. or something, so you can be outside like 24 hours a day. That's not a good time to, you know, you don't want to spend that time writing. You want to be traveling or staying up or, you know, sitting outside and just enjoying.
So when you brought your family to Scottsdale, Ragnar, was it last year, I think? When was it? Was it in June? So you were in that traveling summer phase?
No, it was actually for the Easter holidays.
Okay.
So it's just a perfect time to leave Iceland because at Easter time, Iceland is, you know, in that phase of, you know, it being like still a little bit of winter and not bright enough, not sunny enough. But all around, you know, in Europe and Arizona, of course, it's bright and sunny. So so for me, that's a very good time to get away.
So do you have questions that you might like to ask either Jim or Jeff?
So I was wondering if there's any book that has changed your life.
I didn't hear what you said. Is there any what?
Is there any book that has changed your life?
Is there a book
by that running, has changed your life? If I were running for Miss America, I'd say the Bible, but that's not the one that did it. So I think it would have to be. That's hard to say. Hard to say. I'm really impressed by one book, which I never could write. It's The Evening Redness in a Western Sky, I believe it's called. It's Cormac McCarthy's, and his character in it, the judge, that character just impressed me to no end. I still read that book every once in a while. Just the way he described it. It's like a really rich chocolate cake, that book. You can't read it straight through. You got to just have bits of it. Otherwise, you're not going to survive it. But that's the book that really did move me. Plus, August Wilson's plays. August Wilson, I love him. Gives me a sense of cadence. So those books, I think, helped me quite a bit.
The two, if I could speak, is that okay?
Yep.
The two books that probably made me decide to write are Gone with the Wind, which I read when I was 9 on my couch, my mother's couch in the living room. And for the first time in my life, I read characters who were bigger than the book and realer than the book. Those four characters, whatever you say about the book, those four characters are astonishing. And I thought, okay, that's what stories are about. They're about people. And then when I was about 11 or 12, I started to read Raymond Chandler. And I thought, this is a kind of book I could write. I instinctively understood the structure. It's a really easy structure. Who done it? How do you get him? So those two books, whenever I think about, you know, why I'm a writer, those two books are probably the primary reasons.
What would you answer, Ragnar?
I would probably say the first Agatha Christie book I read when I was like 12. A friend of mine lent me a book, and I think it was The Evil Under the Sun, and it just, you know, opened up this new world of mysteries, and, you know, I was like, it was like magic, you know, and I started reading everything I could find by Agatha Christie and then into other, you know, classic Golden Age authors, and, you know, this is most definitely the reason I'm, you know, I love reading detective stories and writing them.
Christie never seems to age. So do you have a favorite Christie as opposed to the first one?
I think, I think I usually would say Murder on the Links. It's an early Poirot novel. It's not one of her best known ones, but there is something very charming about it. And, you know, and maybe it has to do with, you know, where I read it. I actually could never find a copy in Icelandic when I was looking for it, because it was out of print. So I had to go to like the National Library in Iceland, a very grand old building, and, you know, borrow a copy and read it there on like a Saturday mornings. And so, I mean, maybe that has influenced me, because I think it's quite important where you read a book as well. But that's, you know, that's probably my personal favorite. But I would say like the Murder of Roger Ackroyd, which is probably her most famous book, is probably as well, you know, one of her best. It's like, it's a book I you know, I wish I had written. It's a fantastic concept.
I asked because there are a whole number of riffs on And Then There Were None. I won't go back to its original title, which at the moment would be a serious mistake. But there are a number of authors who have written variations recently of And Then There Were None, which, you know, she really had an amazing mind. My favorite is Murder at the Vicarage because it's funny. This is the first Miss Marple, but there's a lot of humor in it. So there we are. Patrick, are there any comments that you'd like to forward?
Sure.
Patrick's going to step up here and see a little feedback.
Let's see here. I have a gentleman who asks the question, how do your surroundings physical, weather, people, food affect your writing? And it occurs to me that you've been talking a lot about that already, but I thought I'd ask again.
My settings affect my writing primarily in that they suggest locations to write about. When I'm writing, it doesn't matter whether I'm on an airplane or in a coffee shop or in a hospital with my feet up. As long as I have a laptop in front of me, that's essentially where I am when I'm writing. I'm in a loop between me and the laptop and this free-floating question mark that it's always running ahead of me as I write. What's going to happen now? What's going to happen now? But there's no question that when I first went to Bangkok, and I looked at, when I first went to Bangkok, I had a travel agent who was nervous about me. I was a nice American boy, and she didn't think maybe I should be in Bangkok. So she put me into a Sheraton hotel, which seemed really safe. And what she didn't know was that it opened right onto Patpong Road. And I walked out that night at 5 o'clock, and here are all these really friendly women waving at me out of the door, and there's music playing and all the rest of that. And I immediately thought, okay, there are a zillion stories here. And it took me a long time to get around to it, but probably the best book in the series by most people is the story of how Rafferty's wife, Rose, wound up down there from the little farm town that she lived in when she was growing up. And, you know, I mean, there's just a million tragedies on that street, and there's also a million wonderful people. And so anyway, yeah, place interests me more in terms of setting than it does in terms of how it sort of sets me up to work, if that's an answer.
Who's next? Jeffrey?
Well, my books wouldn't be what they are since they're all about Greece and the Greek islands without the setting. They're like a character for my books. And I really find that it infuses the book with something beyond just the story. And so setting to me is really key. And I just find that, in fact, when I'm in Greece, somehow it flows easier. I write, I feel, I sense, I smell the place, the people, everything that's going on. And if I have a question about a local customer, I just ask somebody, I say, oh, they do it this way, and then they argue and they give me the right answer. So I find setting to be very important.
But your books always delve into the history of each place that you go. And for years, as you know, I have said that you're like some kind of Cassandra, writing about things that have happened and will happen in the area that you is under your microscope. And oftentimes what you write about comes true, but the Greeks, current Greeks anyway, didn't really want to listen.
Yeah, well, the last book, Murder in Mykonos, Mykonos.
Island of Secrets.
We'll call it that. Island of Secrets. A month before it came out, the very thing I described as happening in the first opening scene happened in real life. The actual a person was assassinated, and in my book, it was the person was assassinated. He was in a Mercedes, and he was killed by a Bulgarian. The news comes out, this guy who was involved in the very protection business on Mykonos was killed getting in his Mercedes by a Bulgarian. I couldn't believe it. That was exactly what I had written in the book, and it happened a year after I'd written it. So the police started asking me questions.
Right now, you've probably already answered this question, but is there anything else you'd like to throw in?
Well, so as to like where I write the books, I mean, that doesn't really matter. It's usually just at home or on an airplane. I travel quite a lot as well. But, you know, for me to visit the places that I write about is also very important. And, you know, for the island, the book I have, Before the Mist, I mean, that sat on this real island. I was actually there last week as well, but I went there when I was writing the book. And you really get that sense of the place, and you really want to, you know, you really want to put that into the book. And for the first book in the series, Darkness, I spent the night in like a small cabin in the, you know, middle of Iceland in winter. And in it was the coldest night I've ever, you know, experienced. I thought it almost felt like I couldn't breathe. It was so cold. The cabin had no heating. And, you know, that's exactly, you know, the experience that you can only write about if you have actually tried it.
Anything else?
Yes, Ragnar, I have a question from Carolyn, who she says she's very excited to hear that there's going to be a sixth Ari Tour novel coming. What is the title and when will it be released?
So the title is Winter Kill. And I think it's out in France in September this year and in Iceland in October. And I think the English version will be ready and out before Christmas.
Ooh, very exciting. Anything else?
Not really.
All right. Well, gentlemen, it's really been a pleasure talking to you. It's fun to travel around to these different locations with you while sitting here at home and not actually having any travel plans. So thank you so much for joining us. And we'll look forward to your new books. And thank all of you for joining us this afternoon here on Facebook. And we wish you a very happy 4th of July.
Thank you.